people again is that if you like what you're listening to, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online throughout the hour. It's 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopez at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Award-winning author Jerome Charon has produced something like 50 published works over the past 50 years. His latest novel, Ravaging Son, is a blend of the historical and noir genres about crime, corruption, and anti-Semitism in Manhattan's Lower East Side between 1883 and 1913, a world of prostitutes, criminals, opium addicts, peddlers, and scavengers. It's published by Bellevue Literary Press and brings Jerome Charon back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you, Leonard.
You've published 38 novels, 3 memoirs, 9 graphic novels, 2 books about film, short stories, plays, and works of nonfiction. So you're all over the place. Are you working on a project now?
Yes, I'm having a novel on Maria Callas published next year. And I'm also working for the first time on a young adult novel, which will be a sort of recasting of my life in a slightly different way.
Well, you've written works on subjects ranging from table tennis to Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
And weren't you once a tournament table tennis player ranked in the top 10% of players in France?
Yes, I was, but of course, the top 10% doesn't tell you everything. I was a tournament player. I played as well as I could, and I still play now. I have a coach, and I play twice a week, and I love it.
And you were living in France at the time.
I was living in Paris. I lived in Paris for 17 years.
Wow. Well, haven't most of your previous New York novels been mostly set in the Bronx?
In New York City, yeah. some in the Bronx, but in the whole city, Brooklyn, you know, range throughout the whole city.
Well, is this your first time in the Lower East Side?
Well, my first novel was about a Yiddish actor who lived on Lower East Side. And when I was a kid, my grandparents lived there. So for me, it was my spiritual home. You know, refugees came from Eastern Europe before 1924, and my grandparents lived there. When I was a kid, we always went down there, and I hated my grandparents. They hated me. So what I did was walk the streets, and I fell in love with, Orchard Street and the markets, the people, the melodies, the songs, the feelings, Katz's Delicatessen, the Lois Delancey. And so I felt the need to return to that world.
And yet one of your characters describes it as home to every kind of vermin.
Yes. Well, you have to remember in the first part of the 20th century, the Lower East Side was the most crowded, the densest neighborhood in the entire planet. So there was tremendous poverty, tremendous crime, and also a very particular melody that Abraham Kahan, the editor of the Jewish Daily Forward, found. And he's the one who invented the Bintel Brief, which were letters by people who lived on the Lower East Side. He would revise them, and they were always heartbreak stories. And it was a lot of it was an extraordinary time, a sad time, a powerful time, a poetic time.
And Abraham Kahan is a major figure in this novel.
Yes.
The novel is sprinkled with actual historical figures, and It might be difficult for a reader to separate the real-life figures and entities from the characters and places you've invented. In similar attempts of stories like this, don't most novelists just simply create fictional characters that are based on the real-life person?
No, I don't feel comfortable doing that. I wanted to write about Abraham Kahan because he had... you could fictionalize it. Yes, people often do that, but it's not as challenging. It's not as difficult, and it's not as much fun. I wanted to get inside his skin.
So he was, in fact, he died in 1951, so he was around a while.
He turned very conservative near the end of his life, but he was a socialist, and it was at a time when socialism, quote, was not a dirty word, and people understood that you had to share your wealth. And, of course, they didn't on the Lower East Side, but this is what he fought for.
Well, he was an editor, a novelist, a politician,
yes.
One of the founders of the Yiddish language newspaper, The Forward.
Yes.
He was its editor-in-chief for 43 years.
He was fired several times and came back. He always came back because he always increased the circulation. But he was not a great novelist. So, I think he was a wonderful figure. And I didn't want to do a novel based on someone like him that would have meant nothing to me. You know.
And he, as you said, he was a socialist. He was... prominent voice of the Socialist Party of America.
Yes.
But when he was younger, as a socialist, wasn't he involved in attempts to overthrow the Russian Tsar?
Yes, to kill the Russian Tsar. I mean, he was a revolutionary, and he had to flee from Lithuania to come here. And he then sort of became less radical and started the Jewish Forward, you know.
He taught himself English.
Yes.
And became a writer. Quote, breathing a taste of socialism into everything he wrote.
Yes. He believed in humanity, and it's become a dirty word, and it's one of the saddest things about our own time, the whole idea of sharing wealth. We're not allowed to say that. It's become a dirty word.
Wasn't the Forward one of the best-selling newspapers in the U.S. for the time?
Yes, it was. Well, he was. Kahan was called the Pulitzer of Yiddish land, and the Jewish Daily Forward had an incredible circulation. It was much higher than most papers in the United States. It was read all over the world, and it you know. And remember, Isaac Bathsheba Singer's novels were all published. We're all serialized in the Forward. That's how Isaac Bathsheba Singer started. So you see, they did significant work. I mean, they were a wonderful newspaper, and I remember my father reading it every day. And I remember there was a review of one of my books, and the review was not very positive, and it was the first time I saw my father cry. You know, look what they're doing to my son.
Is it still in Yiddish?
There is a Yiddish edition, but it's now mostly in English. Yeah.
You also have a cameo appearance by Henry James in
yes.
this book, in a chapter titled The Master, in which Kahan accompanies him on a trip to Ellis Island.
Yeah, which is true. I mean, it did happen. And when he saw, you know, how the immigrants were treated, he did cry, and he writes about it. Of course, he was very anti-Semitic, but on the other hand, he was very disturbed by what he saw on Ellis Island, as we all should be. I mean, people were treated horribly. People were treated like cattle, you know.
Well, I'm sure your grandparents went there. Mine did.
Yes. Yeah. We wouldn't be here otherwise,
yes.
wouldn't it?
Yeah. You also provide little history lessons that touch upon Manhattan institutions
yes.
like Lord and Taylor, Montefiore Hospital, the Ziegfeld Follies, right, and Woolworth stores. So you were dealing with all the things that you remembered from your youth?
Well, I did research. Woolworth, of course, there was no Woolworth store, but I wanted to put a 13th Woolworth store in the Lower East Side, and that would have been the beginning of gentrification. So Kahan fought very hard against it, and he won, you know.
We had a Woolworth in Williamsburg where I was growing right. up. It was very much a part of the assimilation process.
Yeah, but it would not have been very helpful on the Lower East Side. It would have thrown people out of their houses, and it would have been very destructive.
You also write about the tension between German Jews and these newly arrived impoverished Russian Jews.
Yes.
Like my grandfather.
Yeah. Well, the German Jews arrived in the mid-1850s, and most of them were junk men. They were junk dealers who had push carts and peddled in the South. They became very, very wealthy. And when, you know, Jews began coming from Eastern Europe, they didn't want to be associated with them, and yet they felt responsible for them. So they built the Educational Alliance so that these, you know, mongrel Jews could be educated. And also
these Bulgarians.
These Bulgarians, you know. And also they would station people on Ellis Island to help them so that they would not be completely lost. Because you can imagine, they didn't know the language. Their names were changed. They were tagged. They were thrown in and then thrown out. Some of them had, you know, diseases. They were put in cages. And it was really a horrifying experience.
And Yiddish was a unifying language.
Yes, it was.
The Russian Jews spoke Yiddish as well?
They all spoke Yiddish.
Even though it's a Germanic language.
Yes, they all spoke Yiddish, yeah. Well, you've seen Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even I spoke Yiddish as a kid because I went to a school and my parents didn't speak English, so, it's a wonderful language.
Yeah, but it slowed down assimilation, didn't it? Because people didn't have to learn English right away.
It did, except that the forward championed education, and remember, at that time, City College was, mostly Jewish students from the Lower East Side, and they were assimilated and moved out of the Lower East Side to the Upper West Side of Manhattan, particularly Riverside Drive. But he felt it was very important that they do learn English, even though the Forward was a Yiddish newspaper.
Was the Essex Street Market already there?
Yes, the Essex Street Market was there from the very beginning. Yeah.
And that was part of the assimilation process, I'd imagine?
Yes, it was. And, of course, Orchard Street, where you could buy all sorts of rags, where, you know, mm-hmm. I love Orchard Street. I used to go there every day and buy things and haggle with the merchants and I still love the Lower East Side, even though it's become gentrified and it's, but if you look at the roof lines, you can see what it must have been, 100 years ago.
My guest is Jerome Charon. We're talking about his latest published work, although there are other things he's working on, a novel called Ravage and Sons, published by Bellevue Literary Press. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. I'm not sure how much we should discuss the plot of your novel.
We don't have to discuss the plot.
Well, we should talk about it a bit.
Sure.
Kahan rescues an orphan named Ben Ravage from a trade school and sends him off to Harvard to earn a law degree. He'd found him working in a machine shop?
Yes, he was a sort of orphaned and he helped him get out of a, quote, Jewish bad boy school and sent him to Harvard. And
with the help of Jacob Schiff, who's a real-life person.
Yes, Jacob Schiff was very, very important because he was one of the few German Jews who spoke Yiddish fluently and liked the Lower East Side, whereas the other German Jews really didn't like the Lower East Side at all. So there was a kind of ambivalence about him, and he was the most important financier in the world at that time because he financed the American government. He was richer than the American government.
And railroads. He was the head of the banking firm Kuhn Loeb.
Yeah.
And so he in a way, helped America grow.
Oh, very much so. But Ben Ravitch, instead of becoming a Manhattan lawyer, comes back to the Lower East Side and works for the Kahila, who are Jewish detectives financed by the German Jews to work with the police to sort of get rid of Jewish pickpockets, Jewish prostitutes. And they were the members of the Kahila were really sort of a rat squad who sort of turned against the poor Jews on the Lower East Side. So Ben works against them, and he champions the poor.
Now, was it really a kahila?
Yes.
The word means congregation in Hebrew.
Yes, yes.
Now, they were funded by wealthy uptown German Jews to help the police rid the Lower East Side of criminals and the like.
Well, but in a not very appetizing way. In other words, they weren't there to help the poor. They were there to sort of create a kind of order and work with the police. So Ben, who is a member of the Kahila, doesn't really work with them. He works outside of the law.
And in your novel, Kahan is convinced that the Kahila and its detectives wanted to turn the ghetto into one vast prison farm.
Exactly.
So it's repressing the neighborhood's drift towards socialism? Is that part of its goal?
Well, it would have prevented, you know, all pickpockets. It sort of would have been a closed zone where pickpockets or poor people could not enter, so that Kahan really wanted to keep the flavor and the feeling and the mood and the tone and the power and the poetry of the Lower East Side, whereas the Kahila and the police wanted to kill it, wanted to destroy this neighborhood, which to some degree still exists, even though it's very, very different. The Forward building is still there, even though it's not occupied by the Forward, but it's a neighborhood that remains, that still haunts me, and that's one reason why I wrote this book. It grew out of my childhood, and it remains with me still now.
When was the Williamsburg Bridge built? Because it connected the Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, with the Jewish neighborhood in Manhattan, the Lower East Side.
Yeah, but it destroyed many of the... It was built at the beginning of the 20th century, but it destroyed local shops because the Jews from Brooklyn would come over and instead of, you know, shopping at the smaller places, would go into Ridley's, which was then the most important. There was a Lord and Taylor's also in the Lower East Side.
Really?
Yeah. And
when did that close?
That closed very soon. It moved uptown. You know.
Oh, the original Lord and Taylor's was in the Lower East Side, and then
yes,
they moved uptown to 34th Street or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. But Ridley's was the most important department store on the Lower East Side, and it did accommodate poor Jews. As a matter of fact, some of the clerks learned Yiddish so that they could. And the story begins where Kahan wants to come in and bomb Ridley's and then sees how nice the clerks are to these young women and decides not to bomb Ridley's department store.
Well, it was a thriving business area, including one of the largest cafeterias I've ever seen.
Yes. Yeah, that was right next to the Forward Building. That was a cafeteria that Isaac Bashevis Singer made famous.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ben, your major character here, is often accompanied by his partner, Monk Eastman.
Eastman, yeah.
And he's also a real-life figure?
Yes.
An ex-con from Sing Sing.
Yes. Many people think Monk Eastman was Jewish, but he wasn't. He was the head of a Jewish gang, but he himself was not Jewish.
Was that common?
No, it wasn't common at all. But, of course, history always distorts, and he's turned into this, he's turned into that, and he's considered a Jewish criminal in most encyclopedias, but it's not true. Hmm. He was not Jewish.
Ben is given the job by the Kahila of rooting out the Jewish Mr. Hyde, a villain who attacks the prostitutes of Allen Street.
Right. Lionel Ravitch, Ben's father. Lionel Ravitch is illegitimate. Lionel Ravitch is this Mr. Hyde who both helps and hurts at the same time. He's very rich, and he attacks the prostitutes and beats them up. And Ben is on the trail of his own father in the book. So it's a crime story, but I really wanted to create the Lower East Side as a sort of magic island rather than deal with the strict historical, you know, sense of the place.
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the plot.
Right.
But he's looking for his father without realizing it's his father.
Yes, he's looking for his father, and he's trying to trap this Jewish Mr. Hyde. Yeah.
His father is a wealthy philanthropist, but also a ruthless landlord.
Yes. And often those two things came together. If you think of the Sacklers, for example, and all of the opiates that they did, and yet they have rooms in all of the major museums. You know, it often goes hand in hand. Philanthropy and crime often is wielded in the same way.
Is that still the case, do you think?
Yes, if you look at the Sacklers, you know, and the opiates that they put out onto the street, and they've just recently been disenfranchised, but they practically created an opiate epidemic in the United States. You
know. The Sacklers?
Yes.
They didn't make it into this novel?
No, they came later, but maybe I'll do a novel on them.
Sophie Karp.
Yeah. Clara Karp.
Clara Karp is a Ukrainian refugee actress who performs as Hamlet with lines in Yiddish and English at the Thalia Theater. And Kahan and both the Ravages, father and son, fall under her spell at various times in the novel.
Yeah, they're all in love with her. She was an extraordinary character.
Well, there was a famous Yiddish actress in the early 1900s named Sophie Karp.
Yeah, but I didn't base it on her. I just happened to use the net.
But Clara Karp is not a real person.
No, she is a total invention, accidental with an accidental name that happens. It comes from another actress. Yeah.
Didn't Yiddish theater once thrive on the Lower East Side?
Oh, it not only thrived on the Lower East Side, it also thrived on Broadway. You have to remember, you know yourself, that for many years, New York City was a Jewish city. And so the Yiddish theater was very, very powerful, not only on Second Avenue, where many of the theaters were, but there were also theaters on Broadway.
And isn't there a sidewalk of fame on Second Avenue with stars' names in the concrete?
Yes. Yeah.
Would I recognize any of those names? Molly Pecan,
yeah.
She came to mind immediately.
Yeah, and also a copy of my first novel was sent to her, and she was startled that I, at my age, would be writing about the Yiddish theater. And she sent me a wonderful letter. I wish I had it. I'm not a keeper of letters.
Uh-huh. Even if they come from Molly Pecan. Well,
yes,
people,
I'm stupid.
Many listeners will not even recognize that name, but during her heyday, I would think that pretty much everybody in New York knew who she
Everybody knew Molly Pecan. And,
Jews and Gentiles.
Yes, and she was also on television, you know, and she also, you know, did English parts as well as Yiddish parts. But she was the most famous Yiddish actress of her time.
So this is a time of where there's a cross-cultural activity, a lot of cross-cultural activity. That's kind of all ended.
It's amazing. If you live long enough, you see so many changes. And it's both frightening and exhilarating because it allowed me at my age to go back and look at this lost world and to conjure it up, you know, and to make it into a magical place. Even though it's filled with vermin, et cetera, there still is magic, you know, in the book.
Well, are you stunned by some of the changes? So, for example, I have a telephone in my pocket here.
Yeah.
I have a computer at home.
Yeah.
I can connect to people all over the world on the computer or my phone.
Yeah.
None of that was happening when we were young. And you're older than I am.
Yes, I am. I'm the old man of the sea. But the thing is that these inventions have been very, very helpful. But on the other hand, they've also been harmful because they've disconnected people from one another. And the human connection has been lost, and particularly after the COVID epidemic, there's such isolation, and it doesn't help to have a telephone or a computer. You need that actual human contact, and that's what we're losing every day, and we're losing it more and more.
You see it on the subway, where everybody's looking at his or her phone.
Yeah.
And clicking away, and nobody ever talks to anybody anymore.
Nobody ever looks at anybody. Yeah. And the eye, you know, is so important. It's no longer important when you're texting and in your own little world, you know.
Does that affect how you think about working on a plot for a novel?
No, because I don't feel part of that world. Even though I do text, my wife Lenore thought I would never learn how to text, and I said I didn't want to learn. And then I text like crazy.
But, do you use your forefinger or do you use your thumbs?
I use my forefinger.
Have you noticed that there is an age break that people over a certain age, I think maybe 70 or so, use their forefinger when they type on their phone, and people under that age use their thumbs?
I'm sure, yes. I've seen it. I've seen these magical thumbs, but I'm not capable of doing it.
Well, I hear that it's partly because the younger generation grew up with video games.
Right, exactly, exactly. And I'm not a great fan of video games, but on the other hand, I would love to do one.
Well, you know, you still can. You seem to have all your faculties even now. Are you ever worried? You ever worry you might lose some of your powers?
I don't think you can take it for granted, because Leonard, you know, you can ask your brother, but to write a novel, you have to keep so many things in your head. You have to confront so many things that if you slip up, you know, and you lose the rhythm, you lose the voice. And Philip Roth at some point said, "I can no longer write novels," because he didn't have the energy. It's you know, you have to go back every morning and sort of revisit a world that doesn't exist, that exists only in your head. And it ain't easy, but I love it.
I understand, because I've written two novels that never got published.
Well, that's not your fault. It's the fault of the publishers.
I don't know. I don't have the manuscripts anymore, so I have no way of knowing whether they were good
or
not.
Yeah, but some of the best novels in the world were never published. That's the problem. There's this, the unknown is greater than the known. We only know a small portion of the world because...
But once you start getting published like you did, then it's a lot easier to get republished, get published more and more, because you're already a known quantity.
Well, but I never consider myself as a product, and each novel is different. So it's no more easy now. It's not easier now than it was, you know, when I first began. But, of course, I have a wonderful publisher who's only interested in the literary quality of the work. So I'm very lucky, you know. Most people aren't.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. With Jerome Charon. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of his latest novel, Ravage and Son, the book we're discussing. To do that, just go online to give to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950 during today's show. We'll be happy to send you a copy. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, and we thank you very much. And return to Jerome Charon, talking again about his latest publication, a novel called Ravage and Son from Bellevue Literary Press. And now, since you've done, as I mentioned earlier, such a wide range of books, do you have any idea of what you want to do at any given time? Do you think maybe I should write a novel now? Maybe I should write about table tennis?
An idea comes into your head, and if it stays there, you work on it. And of course, anti-Semitism in this book was very important. And thinking of the tragedy that's just happened in Israel, I mean, it just deepens the loss that one feels in this book about the anti-Semitism at the beginning of the 20th century and the anti-Semitism now in the United States, which flourishes as sort of a major disease.
Are you surprised that it's still happening and that you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene claiming that the Rothschilds are behind forest fire in California?
Well, I mean, what I am surprised is that the word truth no longer means anything. If you say something, you know, it's lie after lie after lie. And so I think, for example, that Biden is a wonderful president, but he doesn't, you know, push his powers. He doesn't talk the way Trump talks. So he isn't as effective, but I hope he will give a very hard punch. And he did give a very hard punch yesterday, and I hope he punches some more.
Well, I interviewed him years ago.
Yeah.
And I was slightly underwhelmed because he was just so laid back.
Well,
I had just interviewed Barack Obama, who was right there.
But I think Biden is a greater president. I think he's never been given the credit. But we're straying from the book. But
it's okay. We're talking about the culture, which is something that you've dealt with in a lot of books.
Yeah.
Why do you think he... I know the polls don't mean anything, but why he's running neck and neck with Donald Trump, despite Trump's legal issue problems.
Well, Trump has, you know, is an advertising man. He's a self-advertiser. It doesn't matter what he says. And Biden is a very modest man. But he's accomplished in a country that's ravaged, that's split in two. He's accomplished more than I think any other president since Roosevelt. And he's helping the environment. He's helping the poor. He's helping get rid of college loans. I think that he's just not a man who sort of pounds his chest and tells you what he's doing, but he does do it. So I admire him a great deal.
Getting back to the book, which is called Ravage and Son, Ravage being Ben's father, Lionel Ravage, you have made him the most important landlord on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
And although he funds charities, helps people make their way through Ellis Island, he's a landlord who mistreats and abuses immigrants. In fact, he seems to love his cat, Chloe, a lot more than his wife.
Well, if you had Chloe, you would too. But the thing is that I wrote that introduction after I wrote this book took me 10 years to write.
So you were working on other projects all along?
I was working on other projects. I had another publisher, and it would take him, a wonderful editor, Bob Weil, but it would take him 3-4 months between each revision of the novel. And when he was doing that, I would go back to Ravage and Son, and now Erica Goldman, who's my publisher at Bellevue Press, loved the book, and so I'm glad I was able to spend all that time revising and revising and revising. You know, it was an endless process.
So did Lionel change over the years?
He didn't.
He's a rather unpleasant character. He bullies young women into sex by sometimes offering them rent relief, other times by pretending to marry them.
Yes, but he lost his cat. You know, and I have a cat, and I don't know, for those people who have cats, if anything happened to my cat, I think I would strangle myself. So
this is before Katz's Deli on the Lower East Side.
Yes, but Chloe is also the name of my cat, even though I call her Quetzal, which is cat in Yiddish. But you have to understand that in that opening, we see Lionel's loss. And what happens to him, he becomes a monster. He turns, you know, from a man who's slightly wicked into a total monster.
Well, he has a number of children out of wedlock.
Yeah.
Is he based on a real-life character?
No. I made up Lionel and his name, Lionel Ravage. I like the name.
Well, Ravage, of course,
yeah,
is a word that can function as a bad last name, but also tells you a lot about how he reacts to the world.
Names are very important to me. I am a lover of names, of finding. It takes you so long to find the appropriate name for the character, even though some of them are historical. And I was glad to put in Henry James because he's the novelist I admire the most and also like the least.
Because he was an anti-Semite.
Not only that he was
an unpleasant person.
An unpleasant person, but you could put all of his sympathy at the head of a pin, and it still wouldn't fill the head of the pin. Hmm. In other words, he was a formalist. He was a lovely, lovely writer. But there is no real deep emotional attachment to any of his characters. So you could say he's a modernist, which I also consider myself. But I do believe in emotion, that you have to pack your sentences with feelings, with deep feelings.
Well, often our heroes are not the best people. As a sports fan,
right,
I've often rooted for athletes I later learned that were awful.
Yeah, most millionaires are awful. But,
you think of millionaires? Unless they're born.
I think they were much nicer when they were paid less.
Well, what about millionaires who turn out not to have actually been millionaires and become president of the United States?
Well, we don't talk about such obscenities on the radio.
In this book, you give us some of the language of the times. Fagin, Shylock, for example. They use generic terms for pickpockets and moneylenders. Does anybody call a moneylender a Shylock anymore?
Yes. Oh, now? No. No.
Even though it comes out of Shakespeare.
It comes out of Shakespeare, but I think, you know, you would be canceled if you used that word. I mean, but that was the word that was used, you know.
Another, you have the Shilly Shally Saloon.
Right, yeah. I love names.
Was that a real place?
No, I just invented it.
Vagabondage is a word you use here?
Yeah.
Jackanapes is a real word.
Yes.
And people call jackanapes?
Well, I don't know if they were, but, you know, remember, you have the power. This is my world, and I have the, it may actually exist, but I have the power over it while I'm writing it. And if jackanapes works for me, then I'm going to use it.
Uh-huh. And it just, the word just pops into your head?
It popped into my
head. Thinking about those days?
Yeah, I try to imagine what it must have been like to, you know, to grow up poor on the Lower East Side. And, of course, you identify with the hero, Ben Ravitch, and he's a kind of Don Quixote who goes into the Essex Market Court, you know, and sort of creates a kind of turmoil because the court is fraudulent, and he's there to help poor Jews out of getting out of legal problems. And so he's attacked and partially destroyed, and at the end of the book, he's enfeebled, but I still love him.
Well, I grew up poor in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Well, once you said bungalow colony in Monticello, I knew that you were poor. So was I, because I had to.
Yeah, well, I don't want to think about being poor as a kid, but that's a whole other matter.
No, I disagree with you, Leonard. I think it's very, very important because poverty also creates a kind of sympathy in the world, and you don't want to lose that sympathy.
I'm speaking with Jerome Charyn, C-H-A-R-Y-N, in case you don't know him, despite the fact that he has published so many different things. His latest publication is a novel called Ravitch and Son. It's published by Bellevue Literary Press. And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. As we mentioned, a major figure in this book is a real-life person, Abraham Kahan, Abe Kahan. And the book opens with him leaving his office one midnight to walk around the docks. And when a sickly-looking hooker comes up to him, he declines her services but offers her money so she can quit working for the night. Now, that's an invention, right?
Yes, that's a total invention.
Does it feel weird inventing things for real-life people?
Not at all.
It's a novel?
It feels very comfortable. In other words, you make the human person more sympathetic than he actually was. You breathe the kind of life into him. And at the very beginning, on page 13, there's a speech by Caliban, you know, from Shakespeare. You taught me language and you taught me how to curse. So, you know, this book is about language. And the gift that I have as a writer is I can take Abraham Kahan for all his limits and turn him into a heroic figure.
And this scene with the hooker allows you to introduce Lionel Ravitch.
Right, yeah.
Now, what happens is the hooker's pimp called a cadet.
Cadet. The pimp was called a cadet. That's an actual word, yeah.
People were called cadets at that time, pimps?
Yeah.
He and his henchmen arrive and threaten Kahan with hatchets.
Yeah.
But then this old man arrives and drives the thugs away, and that's Lionel Ravitch.
Yeah.
So that's how you introduce him.
So you see, there's a kind of moral ambiguity about him, and I think you need that moral ambiguity in a novel, because otherwise, you know, it's just a cartoon, and I didn't want to create cartoon characters.
Now, Ben, when he is working as a detective, he's charged with locating Lila Montague,
is yeah.
it Lila?
Yeah.
The lover of Babette Meyer.
Yeah.
The daughter of a wealthy Kahila member. Now, so you also bring lesbians into this.
Yes, yeah.
Now, would they have been totally hidden at the time? Even now, it's kind of rough for same-sex couples.
Yes, they would have been ostracized, but I wanted to write about them, and with a great deal of sympathy because they were outcasts. You know, I'm writing about a world of outcasts, and Ben is an outcast in his own way. Lionel is. Even Chloe the cat is an outcast. And the sympathy that sympathy is very important for me. I mean, is to breathe a kind of life into the worst villains so that you feel a kind of pain. Even when Lionel is killed, he's murdered by two criminals who hit him over the head with baseball bats. I wanted to feel a certain sympathy for him at his death.
You're not concerned about giving away too much of the plot?
Not at all. Either you like it or you don't.
Mm-hmm. So is it really about the language and the way you tell the story?
It's only about the language. Language is everything. Language is all, as Caliban says. You taught me how to speak and a curse upon you.
Well, I mentioned that you published 38 novels.
Yeah, but probably more. It's probably underestimated.
Uh-huh. You mean perhaps under names that we
No, no, no. I've never written anything under a pseudonym.
Oh, I guess it's your Wikipedia. That's what they say.
It's a little bit old.
Yeah. Wikipedia has misinformation about me as well, so...
Exactly, so...
They have me married and I'm not.
Well, we're going to have that changed.
I hope. So, and three memoirs. So you've had that much of a life story to...
No, what happened, Leonard, is that when I was living in France, I discovered that I lost the power of writing novels, but I could write about myself, and I could write about New York City. So I did these detective novels, and I did these memoirs, and I did a book on Isaac Babel and a book on ping pong. It wasn't that I wasn't writing, but I didn't feel that I'd lost my inventive powers.
Well, you've done pretty much everything. You've done graphic novels, books about film,
novels, yeah,
short stories, and plays.
Yeah. I used to be a member of the Actors Studio. Then I worked with Elia Kazan and Arthur Penn. And
really?
I loved it, yeah.
Would you write a book including them?
I don't know. I might if the occasion called for it. Kazan is not one of my heroes, so it would have to be. I did do a novel about Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth, which we talked about last year. You know, I love Orson Welles on this show. You know, and I love Rita Hayworth. You have to either love or hate the characters you write about. You can't be indifferent. You know, it's Punch and Judy with a twist. It's you've got to feel your own power as you begin a novel, and you've got to be excited. You know, you've got to be aroused.
So, forgive me if I asked you this before. Are you working on another novel now?
I'm working on two novels.
Simultaneous? Did they ever get confusing?
No, they don't ever get confusing. I'm never confused.
You sit down and you enter one world one day and then another world the next?
No, I've finished one. I abandoned one novel to start a young adult novel, which I've finished, but haven't handed in to the publisher. And now I've gone back to the novel I was working on before, which is about a 9-year-old kid who sort of takes over, becomes a crime lord. So it's pretty unusual.
And that's not based on any real people.
No, I invented it. He lives in a hotel called the Concourse Plaza. I don't know if you know that. It's on 161st Street and the Grand Concourse, and it was the most lavish hotel of its time, and now it's an old age home.
Hmm. Well, you're from the Bronx and I'm from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
We're
battlers.
Yeah, well, Bronx people don't know much about Brooklyn, and Brooklyn people don't know much about the Bronx.
I disagree with you. Oh. Bronx people know everything about Brooklyn, but Brooklyn people know nothing about the Bronx.
Okay. So you're working on a number of different projects right now. When am I going to have you back?
As soon as possible, Leonard, because I'm having great fun.
You're having fun, great fun talking on the show.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to talk about in the few minutes that we have left?
Well, I'm also going to be doing a play on Toots Shore. I don't know if you remember who Toots Shore
was. Of course I do.
Yeah, so...
Sure I do.
You have a very prominent actor who wants to play the role, so I have written plays, but now, for example, with Toots Shore's bar, instead of having the bartenders, you can just use holograms, so... I want to create the stage in a way where it's very, very exciting. So, and also, Toots Shore, if you remember, was a sports bar. So I'm going to write about Joe Louis, who was my favorite fighter, and also Joe DiMaggio, because Joe DiMaggio was Toots Shore's great hero. And
and you grew up in the Bronx and the Yankees. He was the star of the Yankees.
Yes, and for a while I lived very close to the Yankee Stadium. And if you are on top of 161st Street, you can see right into the stadium, or the old Yankee Stadium. So
how long before I have you back?
I would say probably I will do my best to be back here next year, and we will have fun speaking.
Well, if I'm still sentient, you're already invited.
Put it on paper, Leonard.
Okay, well, that does bring us to the end of our show. I've been talking with Jerome Charon about his latest publication, a novel called Ravage and Son. It's from Bellevue Literary Press. I have it in a paperback version, but I imagine this was sent to me to do the interview. It's a hard
No, it is published. It's a publisher.
As a paperback?
Mostly paperback. Sometimes they do hardbacks, too. Yeah.
Well, as I said, we've come to the end of the show, and if you'd like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@wbai.org. My great thanks to Jerome Charon for being my guest today. But before I sign off, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep the station coming to you during these economically difficult times. Public radio stations in general are going through a rough time, but we have a particularly hard road to hoe because we don't take what they call funding credits at other public radio stations, which are really ads. We are totally listener supported. So we're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by giving us a call at 212-209-2950, or by going online to give2wbai.org right now. That's 212-209-2950, or give, and the number 2wbai.org. We need your help to keep bringing you this unique, in-depth content, information you usually don't get anywhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate right now can receive a copy of the book we've been discussing, Ravage and Son by Jerome Charon. So why not make that call right now, 212-209-2950, or go online to give2wbai.org. You also might consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy, for $10, $15, $20, or whatever, more a month. And we'll say thanks with a WBAI tote bag to anyone who signs up to become a BAI buddy for $10 a month or more. And you can keep that going as long as you wish and allows us to plan for the future. So if you tune in regularly to this show, why not let us know you appreciate what we do by going online to give to WBAI.org or calling 212-209-2950. You play a part in keeping this historic station, the only one in the New York Dial that's 100% listener-sponsored, alive and thriving with your tax-deductible support. And I hope you can join us again tomorrow when Douglas Brunt discusses his new book, The Mysterious Case of Rudolph Diesel. We'll see you then.
Christina Onnested, it's day five of a war between Israel and Hamas as the death toll has risen to more than 2,000 on both sides, some 1,000 Palestinians dead, 5,000 wounded, and in Israel, some 1,200 dead, 2,400 wounded. U.S. military aid has arrived in Israel as it's reportedly planning a land siege into Gaza. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights is urging de-escalation. Ravina Shamdasani is a spokesperson.
We are faced with an explosive powder keg situation, and we know how this plays out time and again. The loss of Israeli and Palestinian lives and incalculable suffering inflicted on both communities. All parties must respect international humanitarian law. They must immediately cease attacks targeting civilians and attacks expected to cause disproportionate death and injury of civilians or damage to civilian objects.
The UN says 18 of its buildings have been damaged in Gaza from Israeli airstrikes. Among the dead in Gaza are at least 260 children. James Elder is a spokesperson for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund.
Killing and maiming of children is a grave violation, and willful killing is a serious breach of international humanitarian law. We again, like all colleagues here, call on all parties not to target children and take all necessary actions to ensure their protection during these hostilities.
Despite the pleas for de-escalation, the situation is becoming increasingly dire. Gaza's power plant has run out of fuel and electricity has shut down. Hospitals are operating on generators that can last up to 4 days. Running water and heat are largely now inaccessible. Ramil Megari reports from a United Nations school serving as a shelter in Gaza.
Raed Abu Amna, a 47-year-old father of four children, has just decided to stay at the school after an adjacent residential building of seven stories was hit by a warning drone's rocket.
The situation at the school is difficult, but I had no choice but to come here, seeking some place a bit safer.
The UN says that currently there are 72,000 displaced Palestinians staying at schools designated as safe shelters, as a majority of Gaza's population are now vulnerable to either injury or death due to intensive Israeli attacks. Gaza's hospitals are expected to be overwhelmed with mounting casualties. Ashraf Al-Qidra is a spokesperson for the Gaza-based health ministry.
We appeal to all concerned parties to promptly support the health system by providing all essential supplies, including medicines, and provide Gaza with special medical teams, as well as allowing injured people to go for treatment at hospitals out of the territory.
I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
Meanwhile, in the U.S., President Joe Biden has said nothing about innocents killed in Gaza, but has reiterated his support for Israel. Christopher Martinez reports.
We will make sure the Jewish and democratic state of Israel can defend itself today, tomorrow, as we always have. It's as simple as that.
In a speech from the White House, President Biden called the Hamas attack an act of sheer evil, killing more than 1,000 civilians. He says that number includes at least 14 Americans. The State Department says another 20 Americans at least are among those taken hostage.
These atrocities have been sickening. We're with Israel. Let's make no mistake.
Prime Minister Netanyahu had already declared war. He issued a statement on Israel's response.
But though Israel didn't start this war, Israel will finish it.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken will visit Israel in the next few days to discuss aid. At this point, the proverbial fog of war is even stronger than usual, and President Biden says there may be another factor at play. He recalled a meeting as senator with then-Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir days before the start of the 1973 Yom Kippur War.
This is what she said. We have no place else to go. We have no place else to go.
At this point, many people have no place else to go. And still, the fighting continues. I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.